From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Native Son is one of America's most powerful and influential novels about race and class in America. This 1940 book was the first bestseller written by a black novelist. But the scenes relating to the main character's sexuality were deleted at the request of the publisher. A new edition of Native Son reinstates those passages. On today's Fresh Air, a reading and discussion. Also today, we meet one of the last Warhol superstars, Holly Woodlawn, the Holly who was also immortalized in Lou Reed's hit Walk on the Wild Side. And book critic John Leonard reviews Mariette in Ecstasy, Ron Hanson's novel about the clash between the religious and secular worlds. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate Ethics Committee has issued a severe reprimand to California Democrat Alan Cranston for his role in the so-called Keating Five scandal. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Today on the floor of the Senate, Ethics Committee Chairman Howell Heflin detailed the charges against Cranston, describing how the California Democrat repeatedly allowed his fundraising from savings and loan operator Charles Keating to be linked with his efforts to intervene with federal officials on Keating's behalf. Heflin told the full Senate that while Cranston's actions in and of themselves violated no Senate rule or law, his actions nevertheless were improper and repugnant. The committee issued a severe reprimand to Cranston, but fell short of calling for the full Senate to take any action. Cranston spoke to his colleagues today on the floor as well, saying he accepted the committee's reprimand. He insisted his intentions had been proper, but he apologized for accepting Keating's donation so close in time to his official actions that his behavior reflected poorly on the Senate. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Yugoslav Federal Army and Croatian National Guards accused each other today of committing atrocities in the region around the fallen city of Vukovar. The army said that 41 Serbian children were found with their throats cut in a village kindergarten near Vukovar. The Serbian-dominated Federal Army charged that the children were murdered by fleeing Croatian guardsmen. Western photographers said that they'd seen federal soldiers killing Croatian guardsmen in cold blood, including some who were unarmed and trying to surrender. One witness claimed to have seen as many as 80 Croatian fighters killed by the army after the city had surrendered. The newly reappointed Soviet Foreign Minister, Eduard Shevardnadze, says instability in the Soviet Union represents a threat to world peace. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
In various interviews with Soviet media today, Shevardnadze explained why he agreed to return to his old job as Soviet foreign minister. "We have to go to the barricades to save the world," Shevardnadze is quoted as saying, "because an unstable Soviet Union is a major threat to the peace of the planet." Shevardnadze said one of his first tasks will be to visit the leaders of the current and former Soviet republics. He wants to convince them to remain a part of the Soviet Union in some sense. If they don't, he wants to find peaceful ways of making the break and solving the range of political and economic problems that secession will create. Last December, Shevardnadze resigned after 5 years as foreign minister. He was reappointed yesterday by Soviet President Gorbachev. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
The Senate has confirmed William Barr as the nation's 77th attorney general. The 41-year-old deputy attorney general was confirmed for the top job on a voice vote. Barr, who was nominated by President Bush last month, has been serving as acting attorney general since August. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 2 points to close at 2,930. Declines edged advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. President Bush today defended his policy of returning Haitian refugees to their homeland, saying that most of the more than 2,000 boat people intercepted by the Coast Guard are economic refugees. The president said he didn't want to create a policy that would act as a magnet for the Haitians, encouraging them to risk their lives to reach the United States. The administration said that it has stopped repatriating the refugees in compliance with a temporary restraining order obtained by a Haitian refugee organization in Miami. That order is expected to remain in effect through Monday. NASA has rescheduled the launch date for the space shuttle Atlantis. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
NASA announced today that it has targeted this Sunday night for the launch of Atlantis, the last shuttle liftoff of the year. Early this morning, engineers opened the shuttle's payload bay and removed a faulty inertial measuring unit, a navigational tool used to place the military satellite into its proper orbit. A new unit is being installed, and if it passes the pre-launch testing, the countdown clock will begin ticking just after midnight Friday morning. Forecasters say the weather on Sunday will be 60% acceptable for a launch attempt. Liftoff is set for 6:31 p.m. Eastern Time. The six-member military crew is expected to spend 10 days in orbit, deploying the early warning satellite during day one. Landing is scheduled back at the Kennedy Space Center. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The White House said today that President Bush's delayed trip to Australia and the Far East has been rescheduled. The trip was to have taken place next week, but the administration delayed it amid Democratic criticism that the president was ignoring domestic concerns in favor of foreign travel. At the time, Mr. Bush said he wanted to remain in Washington while the Congress was in session. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that the president will now make his four-nation trip in early January. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a few minutes, you're going to hear one of the missing parts of a now classic book of fiction, Native Son, Richard Wright's 1940 novel about a young and brutal black man coming of age in a Chicago slum. This novel is taught in many schools, has influenced many writers, especially African-American writers, but key scenes about the main character's sexual life were deleted at the request of the Book of the Month Club, which was interested in offering the book, but only if it were toned down. Wright agreed to the changes, and Native Son became the first bestseller by an African-American writer. Now those excised passages are restored in a new edition of Native Son, just published by the Library of America. It's part of a two-volume set of Wright's works, which also includes a restored version of his autobiography, Black Boy. My guest, Arnold Rampersad, edited and notated these new editions. Rampersad is also the author of a recent biography of Langston Hughes, and he's the director of the American Studies Program at Princeton University. I'll let Rampersad sum up the impact of Wright and Native Son on American culture.
Never before had one of America's greatest problems, some would say the greatest problem, the problem of race and understanding of race and race relations and so on, never before had it been addressed in as bold and as probably illuminating a way. On the other hand, Wright wrote more than Native Son, and I think if you add up all the work, the autobiography, Black Boy, other pieces of fiction, His essays and also his travel books on highly critical travel books on Spain, for example, or Africa, as in Black Power. When you add it up all together, you have the work of a very, very committed writer to representing reality as he saw it, no matter who was offended by it, either Black Americans or white Americans. And with a keen eye for philosophical and political and cultural issues that are still as important to us now as they were with him. So I think it all adds up to his being an extremely important writer.
I want to ask you, for our listeners who have never read Native Son, to just describe what the book is about.
The book is set on the south side of Chicago, and it opens with an alarm clock ringing in a tenement. Bigger Thomas lives there with his family under pretty horrible conditions. Bigger is estranged from his family, fights with his siblings and his mother, goes off to what is to be his latest job, which is to be a chauffeur in a white household, a very wealthy white household. And on his first day on the job, as it were, he meets the daughter of the household, Mary Dalton, and her communist boyfriend. And pretty soon, Bigger Thomas finds himself in Mary Dalton's room. Her mother comes into the room. He cannot admit that he's in the room, because in the context of the 1930s and of his imagination about where black people are supposed to be, black men in particular in relationship to white women, he is forced to try and conceal the fact that he's in the room. Her mother, by the way, is blind. And he smothers Mary Dalton, and she dies, and he cuts up the body and pops her into the stove, or the oven, I guess you'd call it. And that sets him on the way to a subsequent murder of his black girlfriend, to be pursued for a trial in which his communist lawyer will go up against the district attorney in a long, extended, drawn-out debate about many things, politics, race, and so on. At the end of that, Bigger Thomas has come to some better understanding of himself, some greater sense, clearer sense of his own identity. He admits to what he has done that is wrong, and in that admission he achieves the first stage, if you like, in what I think Wright hopes is his move towards dignity. Ironically, of course, it comes as he's about to go to to be executed, right?
What is the most important scene that was cut from the book?
Well, I think there are two or three that are extremely important. I mean, the scene in which, before meeting Mary Dalton, Bigger Thomas is in a movie house looking at Mary Dalton in a newsreel, cavorting with other debutante types on the beach, with an announcer leering at her in a highly sexual way. In other words, with Mary Dalton being held up in the very American way as a kind of sexual commodity, as an opportunity for Bigger Thomas to indulge his imagination in, I think what we might call either natural or also natural and perverse ways that had been forced upon him by the very marginal and curtailed life he had been forced to lead. There's a scene also where Bigger and a friend masturbate in a movie house. What we have there, I think, right, showing is the extent to which questions of race shaded over very quickly into questions of sexuality, and how, in the case of this novel, they came to a point, as it were, in Bigger Thomas's relationship to Mary Dalton, which, of course, is brief and fatal for Mary Dalton and ultimately for Bigger Thomas.
Let me ask you to read one of the scenes that was deleted in the original edition and has been finally reinstated in this new edition of Native Son. And this is early on in the book. It's a scene where Bigger Thomas and his friend go to a movie theater. And it's the scene we were referring to, where they masturbate in the theater.
They walked along the street in the morning sunshine. They waited leisurely at corners for cars to pass. It was not that they feared cars, but they had plenty of time. They reached South Parkway, smoking freshly lit cigarettes. "I'd like to see a movie," Bigger said. "Trader Horn's running again at the Regal. They're bringing a lot of old pictures back. How much is it?" 25 cents? Okay, let's see it." They walked 6 blocks in silence. It was 11:30 when they reached 47th Street in South Parkway, and the Regal was just opening. They bought tickets and walked into the darkened movie and took seats. The picture had not yet started, and they sat listening to the pipe organ playing low and soft. Bigger moved restlessly, and his breath quickened. He looked around in the shadows to see if any attendant was there, then slouched far down in his seat. He glanced at Jack and saw that Jack was watching him out of the corners of his eyes. They both laughed. "You at it again?" Jack asked. "I'm polishing my nightstick," Bigger said. They giggled. "I'll beat you," Jack said. "Go to hell." The organ played for a long moment on a single note, then died away. "I'll bet you ain't even hard yet," Jack whispered. "I'm getting hard. Mine's like a rod," Jack said with intense pride. "I wish I had Bessie here now," Bigger said. "I could make old Clara moan now." They sighed. "I believe that woman who passed saw us. So what? If she comes back, I'll throw it in her. You a killer. If she saw it, she'd faint. Or grab it, maybe. Yeah." Bigger saw Jack lean forward and stretch out his legs rigidly. "You gone? Yeah. You pull out fast." Again they were silent. Then Bigger leaned forward, breathing hard. I'm gone. God damn. They sat still for 5 minutes, slumped down in their seats. Finally, they straightened. I don't know where to put my feet now, Bigger said, laughing. Let's take another seat. Okay. They moved to other seats. The organ still played. Now and then they glanced back up to the projector's room high in the rear of the theater. They were impatient for the picture to start. When they spoke again, their voices were throaty, drawling, tinged with uneasiness. You reckon it'll go all right? Bigger asked. Maybe. I'd just as soon go to jail as take that relief job. Don't say that. I don't give a damn. Let's think about how we'll do it, not about how we'll get caught. Scared? Oh, no. They listened to the pipe organ. It was humming so low that it could scarcely be heard. There were times when it seemed to stop altogether. Then it would surge forth again, mellow, nostalgic, sweet. We better take our guns this time, Bigger said. Okay, but we gotta be careful. We don't want to kill nobody. Yeah, but I'll feel safer with a gun this time. Gee, I wish it was three now. I wish it was over. Me too. The organ stopped and the screen flashed with the rhythm of moving shadows. Bigger sat looking at the first picture. It was a newsreel. As the scenes unfolded, his interest was caught and he leaned forward. He saw images of smiling, dark-haired white girls lolling on the gleaming sands of a beach. The background was a stretch of sparkling water. Palm trees stood near and far. The voice of the commentator ran with the movement of the film. Here are the daughters of the rich taking sun baths in the sands of Florida. This little collection of debutantes represents over $4 billion of America's wealth and over 50 of America's leading families. Some babies, Jack said. Yeah, man. I'd like to be there. You can, Bigger said, but you'd be hanging from a tree like a bunch of bananas. They laughed softly and easily, listening to the commentator's voice. The scene shifted to and fro over the glittering sands. Then Bigger saw in close-up the figure of a slight, smiling white girl whose waist was encircled by the arms of a man. He heard the commentator's voice. Mary Dalton, daughter of Chicago's Henry Dalton, 4605 Drexel Boulevard, shocks society by spurning the boys of LaSalle Street and the Gold Coast and accepting the attentions of a well-known radical while on her recent winter vacations in Florida. The close-up showed the smiling girl kissing the man who lifted her up and swung her round from the camera. Say, Jack, huh? That gal there, in that guy's arms. That's the daughter of the guy I'm going to work for. They lived at 4605 Drexel. That's where I'm going to go tonight to see about that job. For real? Sure. The close-up faded, and the next scene showed only the girl's legs running over the sparkling sands. They were followed by the legs of the man running in pursuit. The words droned on. Ha! He's after her! There! He's got her! Oh, boy! Don't you wish you were down here in Florida? The close-up faded, and another came, showing two pairs of legs standing close together. Oh, boy! Said the voice. Slowly, the girl's legs strained upward until only the tips of her toes touched the sand. Ah, the naughty rich! There was a slow fade-out while the commentator's voice ran on. Shortly after a scene like this, shocked Mama and Papa Dalton summoned Mary home by wire from her winter vacation and denounced her communist friend. Say, Jack, yeah? What's a communist? Damn if I know. It's a race of people who live in Russia, ain't it?
Well, I must compliment you on your reading. It was a wonderful reading.
Thank you.
Now, how do you think that reinstating this scene into Native Son changes how we read the book?
What they do is they provide what has been for a long time, I guess, since 1940, a kind of puzzle, the last piece in a puzzle about Bigger Thomas. I mean, he's always seemed, I think, to critics, a strangely limited person, a kind of automaton almost. Wright wanted to show that sex was an absolutely indispensable part of the whole discussion concerning race. Not about 3 years before Native Son appeared, you had William Faulkner in Absalom, Absalom, offering us his fictional meditation on the question of race, his most profound and most intricate. And there again, I mean, Faulkner understood very clearly that you cannot talk seriously about race in this country without also talking about sex. And to take a character and to strip away a central character like Bigger Thomas and to strip away his sexual feelings is to reduce him to something that is almost incomprehensible. And, of course, there's also the element of a warning, and Wright was walking a pretty fine line there. I mean, there had been many accusations about black men leading to all kinds of lynchings and stereotypes and so on. Yet still he was determined to risk the danger of being misunderstood, of having been seen as creating another kind of stereotype by making Bigger as sexual a being as he did intend to make him. To take that away is really just to make Bigger less than human.
My guest is Arnold Rampersad, who edited and notated new editions of the works of Richard Wright, including a restored edition of Native Son. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Arnold Rampersad, editor of a new two-volume set of the works of Richard Wright.
One of the pieces of Wright's that you've republished is a really fascinating essay from 1940 called How Bigger Was Born, and it's Wright's explanation of how he created this character and all the kind of intellectual thought that went behind creating this character, who is, you know, hardly an intellectual, someone who's always acting on instinct. Not on intellect. Do you think that the novel was at all misunderstood in its time? I mean, if anybody would have presumed that Richard Wright was more like Bigger Thomas as opposed to the intellectual that he really was?
Well, I think the response was definitely complicated. It is said that Book of the Month Club buyers in 1940, many of them assumed that they were buying a murder mystery, and then they discovered it was not that at all. There was a mystery and there was a murder, but there were at least two killings, but it was not whodunit. So that's one way in which I think the book was misunderstood. Lots of people felt that Wright had betrayed the race. I mean, there was both pride at Wright having achieved his national reputation with his book in the black community, but also a sense that he had emphasized some of the least attractive aspects of the culture, even though he was also at the same time emphasizing the horrors of segregation and racism. The book has been seen as advertising a kind of cultural nationalist position, and has been seen as exactly the opposite, a place in which Wright works out some of his hostilities against the black community. So I think that it stands there in the way major texts inevitably stand, capable of multiple interpretations, especially as our own reality changes historically, the culture's reality changes, and we see the work in a different way because it continues to speak with many voices on a variety of issues.
You know, Richard Wright in this essay expresses his concern that he knew that some people in the black middle and professional classes would accuse him of creating a character that wasn't representative of what black people were really like, just representative of a minority. And he also knew that a lot of white racists could read this book and say, see, we told you, this is what black people are like. But he decided not to censor himself. You know, and I'm thinking what a contemporary dilemma this was. I mean, he wrote this essay in 1940. The book was published, you know, the novel was published in 1940. But even today,
People are so concerned that they're not going to be able, that they're not going to be creating positive role models in their fiction, and they're often criticized for that.
Yes, for Richard Wright, there was almost no problem. He was, from the beginning, so you can call it either alienated from both the black and the white communities of his native South, or so dedicated to telling the truth that there's virtually no ambivalence in his writing. 1937, he published an essay called Blueprint for Negro Writing, in which at the beginning he dismisses virtually all black writing before his own time as being essentially obsequious, black writers curtsying before white public opinion, seeking favors. And he was determined that he would not write in that way, but would write regardless of the reaction in the black community or the white community, so long as he satisfied himself that he had told the truth. And I think that he stuck by those guns to the very end of his life. He was, I think bravery was perhaps the most notable aspect of his face, if you like. He deeply admired H.L. Mencken, and in fact traces his real growth as a writer to coming across in the South while he is growing up, while he's still quite young, coming across the words of H.L. Mencken and learning from Mencken how to use, quote, words as weapons. Mencken, the great iconoclastic journalist. And I think that's the way Wright saw writing, as a kind of warfare almost, a warfare with the forces of ignorance, intolerance, bigotry.
At the end of Native Son, when Bigger Thomas is about to be executed, he's in his cell with his lawyer, Max. And Max is trying to get Bigger to think about what he felt that led to the murders. And Max is trying to make social connections. And Bigger Thomas says, "I didn't want to kill, but what I killed for, I am. What I killed for must have been good. When a man kills, it's for something. I didn't know that I was really alive in this world until I felt things hard enough to kill for them." And the lawyer's eyes are full of terror after Bigger Thomas says that. What does that passage mean to you?
Well, I wish I knew exactly. I mean, I suppose I should know what it means to me. But I've never been certain I understand completely what it means. One thing it could mean is that Max, as with what might call, I don't think it's the most accurate description of his ideological quality, one might call him a liberal, is seeing a level of dehumanization in an individual that he had no idea existed previously, that somebody could be so elementary in his sense of himself that it takes an act of murder for him to begin to feel alive and to define himself in terms of guilt and blame and not in any kind of positive sense. Max is horrified to know that such a person exists, and I think Max is also well aware that there are thousands and thousands of Bigger Thomases who kill no one but who have that same rudimentary sense of themselves as human beings, and I think that is what Max recoils from, and the whole idea of defining yourself in terms of your crime. It's Dostoevsky, but Max is not prepared to find it in America. But there it is, and that's what Wright wants to point to, that the problem is as serious as that.
Arnold Rampersad, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Arnold Rampersad edited and notated the new 2-volume set of the works of Richard Wright, published by the Library of America. Rampersad directs the American Studies program at Princeton University. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the 1973 hit Walk on the Wild Side, Lou Reed sang about a man who shaved his legs, then he was a she. The person Reed sang about was Holly Woodlawn, one of the last of the Warhol superstars, the star of the film Trash. Holly has written a memoir called A Low Life in High Heels. Coming up, we find out how a shy, skinny boy named Harold Asenberg transformed himself into the glamorous Holly Woodlawn. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Mariette in Ecstasy. It's Ron Hansen's novel about a young woman who enters a convent and undergoes a mystic transformation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Yugoslavia, hundreds of patients have been evacuated from a badly damaged hospital in Vukovar. This move followed a day of tense negotiations between the International Red Cross and Serbian leaders of the Federal Army. Patients were forced to go to a Serbian hospital, even though almost all of the wounded wanted to stay in Croatia. Pierre Vickery has more on the story.
A spokesman for the European Community Monitoring Team in Croatia said all but those too ill to be moved have now been evacuated from the Vukovar hospital. It had originally been planned to transfer the patients to hospital in other parts of Croatia, but the army maintained that the route westwards would be too dangerous, especially after dark. They cited continued fighting in the region between Yugoslav army units and pockets of Croatian army resistance. The decision to transfer the patients to Serbia caused considerable friction with the International Red Cross. Their delegates were to have supervised the evacuation, but a Red Cross representative in Zagreb accused the Yugoslav army of having hijacked the evacuation. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Soviet President Gorbachev presented a grim picture today of the state of the Soviet economy as he called on Parliament to approve new financing. The Soviet leader pointed to falling Soviet production and declining foreign aid, but he offered no concrete measures to stop it. Industrial production is expected to fall by 7%, and exports are off by 31%. Newly released former hostage Thomas Sutherland says it feels great to be free after spending 6.5 years held captive in Lebanon. Deidre Berger in Wiesbaden has more on the story.
For most of his captivity, Thomas Sutherland and other hostages with whom he was held were chained to the wall. Sutherland spoke at length about his captivity today at a press conference in Wiesbaden, Germany. The Scottish-born educator says he was moved 16 times during his 6 years of imprisonment. He says he was only physically mistreated once, when he was beaten during a 12-day stay in an isolation cell without light. Sutherland, who spent much of his captivity together with AP reporter Terry Anderson, said the hostages eventually were given reading material and access to a radio. The 60-year-old agricultural specialist, who appeared with his family at the press conference, appears to be in good health and spirits after his long ordeal. Sutherland says he is considering resuming his post at the American University in Beirut and might write a book with his wife about his experiences. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Wiesbaden.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 2 points to close at 2,930.01 on volume of 191 million shares. This is NPR News. President Bush has authorized $1.25 billion in grain credits for the Soviet Union, along with $165 million in other aid. A spokesman says the aid is to help ease conditions this winter in the Soviet Union. Officials said that the loan credits will go to both the central government and the various Soviet republics which have agreed to take responsibility for the debt. The first of the credits will become available now, with 3 other installments next year. Democratic presidential hopeful Bob Kerry repeated an apology today for an off-color joke he told at a political roast last Friday. Kerry told a joke that could be offensive to gays, lesbians, and women during what he thought was a private conversation with a fellow Democratic candidate. But a TV network's microphones picked up the comments. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Nebraska Senator Bob Kerrey said today that the response to his remarks has caused him to meet the unpleasant part of himself, prompting him to evaluate and change his own behavior. At a press conference in Los Angeles, the senator began the conference by saying the joke was an insensitive one told by a temporarily insensitive and ignorant politician.
I must say that I have told jokes like this in the past and didn't give it a second thought. And the fact that it's public today, I think, merely opens up a problem of insensitivity that very often men have in these kinds of moments.
Kerry, who has name recognition among just 3% of the public, acknowledged today that he may have caused irreparable damage to his presidential aspirations. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
In Switzerland, an earthquake measuring 5.5 on the Richter scale hit the Eastern Alps this morning. It was the strongest quake in the country in nearly 50 years and caused damage but no injuries. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We're about to meet the person who inspired the first verse of Lou Reed's 1973 hit, Walk on the Wild Side.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked away across the USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way. Shaved her legs and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side.
The Holly of that song is my guest, Holly Woodlawn. Woodlawn was one of the last of the Andy Warhol superstars. And along with Jackie Curtis and Candy Darling, Woodlawn was known as one of the Warhol girlettes, one of the men who passed as women. Woodlawn is best known for her debut role in the Warhol Paul Morrissey film Trash. She played the girlfriend of a drug dealer, played by Joe D'Alessandro. In this scene, Woodlawn has brought over a prep school boy she's just picked up who wants some drugs. Woodlawn figures she can get some from D'Alessandro.
Listen, hey, you got anything?
No.
Because he wants to come.
Nothing.
He's got bread.
Yeah, I know, but I don't have anything.
He's from Yonkers.
That's great.
Yeah, it's cute.
Yeah, really great.
Nothing, huh?
Aren't you glad I cleaned up? Not even later.
He looks nice.
But, yeah, he looks great. He's a little kid, ain't he?
So what? He's got bread.
Yeah?
Bread.
You don't want any bread. You want something else.
So what? You can have both.
You can have both.
Right?
Yeah, okay.
It's going to hurt you.
It's not going to hurt
nothing,
me.
Nothing, huh?
No.
Nothing.
Holly Woodlawn has written a new memoir called A Low Life in High Heels. Holly's birth name is Harold Eisenberg. The name Holly was inspired by the character of Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's. The Woodlawn part comes from Woodlawn Cemetery. But what was Harold Eisenberg like before he became Holly Woodlawn?
I was, shy and skinny and I had buck teeth and, and gawky looking and stupid looking. I didn't like the way I looked, And then one day, after I moved to New York, and discovered makeup, people started telling me how pretty I was. So, why not? So I stayed that way.
Do you remember the first time you put on a woman's clothes?
Well, actually, it came in spurts. Yeah. As the Lou Reed song goes, Holly came from Miami. I shaved my legs in Atlanta, Georgia, and plucked my eyebrows there. And by the time, I think in North Carolina, I did something else. I put on a blouse and in Philadelphia, the land of brotherly love. Pantyhose. And by the time I landed in New York City, I was a full-blown woman.
What did you like about it?
First of all, the fact that I was more comfortable and the attention that I got from,
You got more attention just as a woman than as a man.
And I just felt more comfortable, inside, sort of like my soul, so to speak. I felt, freer. It was easier for me to speak. Just be. And as Harold, quote unquote, I just was always nervous, couldn't get it out.
Why did you hitchhike across the USA?
Because I only had $11.
Well, why did you leave home?
I was 15. My parents, they just found out that I was hanging around with the wrong kind of people, you know, in their eyes. I just discovered, they had just discovered that I was gay, and I was, you know, hanging out with these mad, insane, insane queens in Miami Beach. And they found out, and, you know, we just, it was tough. And I think I wasn't doing too well in school, and I had to go to summer school, and I wanted no part of that. And so some friends of mine said, listen, we're going to New York, and you got to come with us. It's fabulous over there. The streets are paved with diamonds, you know, that diamond dust. And so I said, sure, why not? I did. And it wasn't easy at first, but, I sort of stayed on.
Well, you made a living hustling at first.
I did everything at first. I mean, you know.
When you were hustling as a woman, right?
Actually, no. I was hustling more as a transvestite. You know.
So people could tell they were never like surprised.
No. Oh no, no.
When that's they found out what was underneath.
Yeah, that's why I never got in trouble because they knew.
It's amazing the way you used to travel back and forth between worlds. You know, like you got a job as a sales girl at Saks. You had modeling jobs in other stores, but you went to beauty school as a man.
Yeah, well, that was in the beginning when I first was sort of like, that was doing the transition from a man to a female. I was going to beauty school. I was living in Brooklyn, and I was going to school in Manhattan. And I was living in Brooklyn as this guy's wife, and going to school as Harold Eisenberg. And so what I would do is I would take the subway from Brooklyn to New York as a woman, go into the bathroom, change into Harold, go to school, and then do the opposite on the way back. And after a while, it just got so tiring that one day I just went to school as Holly. And, so much for that. They, you know, threw me out. And then I just, you know, I was also doing hormones, so I had breasts.
You were doing hormones because you were thinking of having a sex change operation.
Yeah, actually twice. We saved up the money, and both times I just couldn't do it. I had this money in my hand, and instead of John Hopkins Hospital, instead of going through with it, I just decided to go shopping.
Why did you decide not to go through with it after saving and preparing for so long?
It's so final. It's just one of those things that, you know, there's no turning back. And I just didn't feel I knew yet what I really wanted to be.
Well, looking back now, do you have any regrets about not changing yourself physically?
No, not at all. No. I'm pretty much happy the way I am.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Holly Woodlow, and has written a new memoir called A Low Life in High Heels, A Walk on the Wild Side with Andy Warhol's Last Superstar. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Holly Woodlow is my guest. In the introduction to your memoir, Paul Morrissey, who wrote and directed a couple of the films that you are in, the Andy Warhol productions, Trash and Women in Revolt, he says that the first time he came across you, it was in an interview with you. There was an article that had an interview with you in which you talked about your success as a major star in Andy Warhol productions. And, of course, you'd never been in a Warhol production. Warhol never met you. And Morrissey says this was a brazen lie, but the lie appealed to his comic sense. And he had a hunch that you would be an interesting character. So he called you up and he cast you without meeting you, without auditioning you. He just wanted to give you a shot.
Yeah.
What's your end of the story?
That's what happened. I was in a play, and off Broadway, one of these experimental theater things. And we got... some good press, and I was being interviewed for this paper, and I just wanted to be a Warhol, you know, a superstar. I wanted to be a Warhol superstar. I wanted to be one of the Warhol people because I had friends that were, you know, Candy Darling and Jackie Curtis. So I told this interviewer that I was, you know, his next superstar. And when Andy and Paul read it, you know, they said, who is this person? You know, and they used to see me at Max's all the time. I used to run in screaming and yelling, you know, and with frizzed out hair and lots of eye makeup and short mini dresses and, you know, and Paul was working on Trash and thought I'd be good in it. And, you know, so I figured, you know, why not? Perfect typecasting.
What was the most outrageous scene that you're in? And I'll ask you to describe it in language we could actually use on the air.
Oh, no, God. My favorite scene is the scene with a welfare worker trying to get my shoes. I'm wearing these silver shoes, and he wants to give me. He'll give me welfare if I give him the shoes. And meanwhile, I have a sister who's pregnant, and so I get the idea that if I, you know, stuff a pillow inside my blouse, and that I'll be, you know, be eligible for welfare. Anyway, the pillow comes, it, you know, falls off, and. He wants to turn these shoes into a lamp, but there's another scene that I will never live down with a beer bottle.
Did you feel that you actually fit in with the Warhol crowd once you started working with them?
When I first got involved with, I always thought that you had to be insane and do drugs and be crazy and, you know, to be and. That's what made, you know, Warhol superstars, which it did during the 60s. But then, you know, then after, you know, a while, the whole Warhol thing turned into a business, specifically after he was shot. And so I came in, you know, sort of late on that part. And I still thought, you know, to be a Warhol star, you just, you know, had to be crazy and demented. And so I really didn't fit in with their, you know, after the movie was done, they just sort of like, you know, didn't want anything to do with me. And
why?
Oh, because I was that crazy person, and they, you know, they just, like I said, they were a business. They hired me for 6 days to do this film. And, you know, after that, it was, you know, forget it. It was over, you know. My job was done. Then the movie went on to, you know, make a lot of money. You know, so I was a little bitter for a while there.
You wanted to be in the spotlight so bad, but you blew your chance to be in the spotlight on the night of the opening of Trash. You were actually in jail that night.
Oh, yes. I was, yeah. What I did was, well, you know, like I said, I only made about $125 for Trash. And I was hanging around with, you know, with a lot of, you know, speed freaks at the time. So, and we knew this girl who was subletting this apartment from a French diplomat's wife. So a friend of mine had the bright idea to, you know, we found her checkbook and, you know, her her passport. So anyway, so I went, to make a long story short, I went into the UN building, the bank in the UN building, dressed as a Madame Chardonnay, and took out $2,000 out of her checking account and got away with it. And then the drugs, you know, ran out. And then I went back. But the second time I was just like so nervous. I went across the street to this bar and, you know, I had a couple martinis and just went in there screaming with this French accent, you know, and got caught. And they threw me into the women's house of detention. And I stayed there a very short time when they found out what I was. And then they put me in the men's house of detention.
When they first took you to the women's detention center, how come you didn't protest right away? How come you didn't, like, reveal that you were really a man right away before they found out the hard way?
Because I really thought I can get away with it. And I did, you know, first of all, I was scared, and I didn't know that, you know, that they were really going to, like, search you. I mean, you know, I've never been in jail. I just thought they'd just throw you into a cell and, you know, whatever.
How did they treat you at that moment of revelation? Were you punished for it more?
The whole thing was humiliating. But The worst part was when they put me in the men's house of detention, and there I was, you know, in this Chanel suit, you know, this, and the only one there. And the guys just went berserk.
Do you see your whole life as theater?
No, not my whole life. But a lot of it, yeah. Especially when I'm dressed up and, you know, making public appearances.
Is that how you're most comfortable when you're transforming life into theater?
No, because I also like, you know, being alone. But it's fun. It's certainly more fun.
What have you been doing for money?
I was working in a novelty shop as a cashier.
Was it an interesting shop where interesting people came?
Oh, yeah, yeah. John Waters used to come in there, Debbie Harry. All my friends would come in and say, Holly, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm writing a book.
Did you like people to know that you were Holly Woodlone when you worked in the shop, or did you want to be more anonymous? Did you ever feel bad about having to work that kind of job?
Not really. I mean, it was just fun having something to do. But, you know, for the past 2 years, this book has really, you know, has taken up most of my time. Of course, I lived on the advance.
Right.
And my parents helped me out a lot, too.
You know, it's interesting. You describe in your book how your parents have really stuck with you. I guess there was a lot of friction when you initially ran away from home, or hitchhiked away from home and so on. But you say that over the years they've
With the best of friends. You. My father just read the book. He thinks it's hysterical. And doesn't believe a word of it.
Self-protection. Uh-huh. Okay, well, I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Holly Woodlone's new memoir is A Low Life in High Heels. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Let's see what stories they're covering. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Tonight we'll talk with the Foreign Affairs Minister of the Republic of Serbia. He tells me that his government has no territorial expansion in mind in Yugoslavia, but envisions a special status for the regions of Croatia now captured by the Federal Army. Soviet expert Marshall Goldman talks with Robert Siegel about his new book concerning the changes in the Soviet Union, Glasnost and Perestroika. Marshall Goldman also tells us a Soviet joke. Bob Mondello reports on the Frank Capra film It's a Wonderful Life, which opens tonight on stage here in Washington, and Tom Manoff on the opera Boris Godunov.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Religion doesn't sell books the way sex does. Book critic John Leonard has a review of a new novel set in a convent that he wants you to know about.
The shortest novel I have read this year is also the best. In August 1906, in upstate New York, 17-year-old Mariette Baptiste enters the convent of the Sisters of the Crucifixion as a postulant, wanting to become a nun. By Christmas Day, her hands are bleeding, and so are her feet. Mariette, in ecstasy, has not only talked to Jesus Christ, she has suffered his wounds on the cross. I don't believe it's possible, says a priest. I do believe it happened. One sister is not so sure. We have had entirely too much mysticism here, she says, and too little mortification. Another sister takes the easy way out. God gives us just enough to seek him, and never enough to fully find him. To do more would inhibit our freedom, and our freedom is very dear to God. Nobody seems to want another saint. The simplest question asked in a text as dense with meanings as a Dead Sea Scroll is this one. If you don't believe in miracles, why are you in business? If Mariette's in ecstasy, so is Ron Hansen's prose, a miracle itself, and is hard to explain. Flannery O'Connor is the only American writer who comes to mind, but I'm reminded more of Japanese painting and French poetry, of medieval mystery plays, John Donne, and St. John of the Cross. Yet this is Ash Wednesday. Where is T.S. Eliot? The weather and the landscape turn like pages on the church calendar, with a mass for every martyr. We hear about the history of stigmata from St. Francis of Assisi on, we are introduced to St. Teresa's The Way of Perfection and Dame Julian of Norwich's Revelations on Divine Love. We are made to think about sexual hysteria. Mariette's own father, a doctor who smells of iodine, tweed, and Turkish cigarette smoke, would like to believe her ecstasy is a disease. We meet nuns in their assigned seats in choir stalls, tiered like jury boxes, and in hayfields with their ringing scythes, and on their knees to scrub stone floors, and with habits tied high around their thighs to stomp the grapes to make wine in the great oak vats, and listening to Vivaldi. But as we are watching, so are we watched, by toads and falcons and turtle doves on the telephone wire. From the campanile, as if through God's eye, we see torn clouds in slow gait to the south like a straggle of gray and white house dogs hobbling to their beds. We know, after the green marble altar, the limewood pieta, the iridescent peacock, after the ox with the wings of Luke, the lion with the wings of Mark, the eagle symbolizing John, that anything can happen, and everything does, under a hideous Spanish cross and a painted Christ that is all red meat and agony. We are not at all astonished when Mariette's red-stained handkerchief smells of Easter lilies, when blood scribbles down her wrists and ankles and scrawls like red handwriting on the floor, when the convent decides it just can't handle these wonders and mysteries. We aren't astonished, but we are spellbound. I won't tell what happens next. Listen, though, to Mariette, 30 years after her ecstasy. Christ still sends me roses. We try to be formed and held and kept by him, but instead he offers us freedom. And now when I try to know his will, his kindness floods me, his great love overwhelms me, and I hear him whisper, "Surprise me."
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Mariette in Ecstasy by Ron Hansen. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We meet two writers on the next Fresh Air, British novelist A.S. Byatt, author of the bestseller Possession, and Ethan Kanan, a novelist who also practices medicine, and has some interesting insights into how patients describe their problems to their doctors. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.